little bit about how those books came to be written and what they're about. I never planned on being a writer. When I left university, I got a job as a diplomat, and while I was traveling, I fell very ill and was ill, well, for the best part of 10 years, most of my mid-20s. And I always feel that a writer's life involves long periods of solitude, sort of antisocial behaviour, of self-doubt and sort of empty space. And I kind of had all those things done for me. I didn't have to sacrifice anything for the writer's life. So I kind of fell naturally into writing while I was sick. And I wrote very much for myself. I began imitating, I guess, writers I was really in love with at the time, writers like Jorge Luis Borges, the Argentinian writer, and Italo Calvino, both very playful short story writers, both writers who made the act of writing itself look quite fun. Always, I guess, as a reader, I'd been quite enthralled to writing. It seemed far too difficult a thing to do. But so, from imitations, I found quickly I had my own ideas for stories, and over about 2 years, I put together 40 or 50 stories. They came very easily. They were quite bleak at heart because I was really quite ill at the time and suffering. And I guess they illustrate various states of sort of mental uncertainty, and as such, they're quite dreamlike. They play around in different styles a lot. There's genre of stories, there's science fiction, there's contemporary stories, there's historical stories, there's stories written in different voices. And there's a long series of stories purporting to be dreams. The easiest of which really was a dream, not in that I dreamt it and wrote about the dream, but because writing was all I had during that time, I used to dream words a lot. I used to get dream words on a page, and just a couple times I woke up and was still able to see the words on the page. So the very easiest story in here, I simply woke up one morning and transcribed. The rest were a little bit more work. I'm just going to read a very short extract from a story called, for reasons too complicated to explain, Winter Luxury Pie. And this is I guess effectively it was trying to be an American multi-generational family saga in about 14 pages. And it's narrated by a young American farm girl. I can neither do an American accent nor a falsetto, so you'll have to let your imaginations guide you. She's one of triplets. Her slightly elder brother, Harry, and a slightly younger brother called Jeremy or Jer. And Jer's the bright one of the family. He's been homeschooled. He's been entering spelling bees for most of his life, and that is the reason why there's occasionally some odd vocabulary through the story. Just ignore the vocabulary. Don't worry about it. I think I've forgotten what half of it means. And this is a small section from the middle of the story, basically about her love life. When I was young, and after learning one day in school about erosion, I became pretty certain that the end of the world was nigh. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. I developed this terrible fear that it would just wear away. This was precisely not the kind of fear to mention to my dad. He shouted for Jer and then got us to calculate, without the aid of a calculator, which with Jer around is not so much of a handicap, about how long it would take for the world to erode, given a posited rate, taking account of the different kinds of rock that made up the earth, and taking into account, too, countervailing processes, such as the diagenesis of sediment. Coming up with a number with a name bigger than I remember somehow didn't allay my fears, but I did learn to keep them to myself next time. Thanks to working with Jer and helping him learn the long lists of words which required cramming for spelling bee entrance, I was doing pretty well at school. Three concurrent educations, on the farm, in school, and vicariously through Jer, while not exactly giving me clear direction in life, had provided me an essential stylism. For a while there, it looked like I might escape the farm. The acreage was shrinking anyway, and everything that was remained was still being run by Grandma, with some help from Ma. And I was able to get to college a year after Harry, where I majored in French. My love life has been sparse. Remitting, perhaps, is a better word. The action has always fallen a little short of the required standard, and I never really thought that my standards were unreasonable. Let me name and shame, for example, Tom, the football player. After pursuing me a couple of weeks, he came back to my room one night, a bit nervous and overcompensating with a fraudulent assurance. After a while, he took off his shirt and he did a few push-ups and then asked me if I wanted to sleep with him. Let me elaborate on that one. What he actually did was flex his muscles and say, "You won't get a chance to sleep with a body like this very often." I felt terribly, terribly sorry for him. It was painfully clear that no one would ever compete with the love he so clearly got from his mirror. Or take Mike, who one night in bed went through a whole bright pleiad of names before he landed on mine. And then later, after a minute's recuperation from a sudden interfemoral intervention by my knee, claimed to have been joking. Neither is my worst experience, not by a clear country mile. For me, there was a boy once, a boy who changed everything while he was around. Everything in my life gained meaning or lost it according to whether I shared it with him. He left. I still imagine myself pointing things out to him as I walk the fields. The cobalt bluebirds beneath the willows, flame-breasted cardinals on the fence post, one or two rare Helobius species visiting from the lowlands, a myriad chromatic butterflies crowding like a ticker tape parade. It all just seems like wasted beauty without him. I can't say his name. All I'll say is there's not one of us without farm soil in our soul somewhere. And then lately, there's Bob. Persistence is his middle name. Hope, unfortunately, is in fact his last. He wore me down in a sweet kind of way. It happened one night, as the movie has it, my last year in college. And thereafter, he seemed to assume that I was the girl for him. Sometimes he acts like we're already married. I think he's puzzled when I run away and find space for myself. But I think, too, that he tells himself it's just one of my quirks. Just me and not him. And he puts up with it. I didn't tell him I was coming back to the farm and he doesn't know where it is. But it's only a matter of time. With Bob, everything is just a matter of time. It all wears away, however long it takes. I just realised I'm glad I put those in reach, otherwise I'll see how far I can range. And now for something completely different, as they say. Having said that the stories came fairly easily and fairly rapidly over a short period of time, I then spent 3.5 extremely slow and painful years writing a very short novel. I had no clue how to write either when I began writing. But stories you can kind of fit in your head, you can kind of get an idea and get the whole thing in your head and pretty much get it down in one go. So having done that for the stories, I then tried to do the same thing for a novel and my head kind of exploded because it turns out they're quite, even the short ones are quite big and complicated things and a bit too big to fit in your head, even if eventually they do get down on paper. And I wrote, I guess, what's quite an unusual first novel. It's ostensibly a historical novel, though I never really felt I was writing a historical novel at the time. I was just trying to deal with some of the stuff that was going on in my life and my mind, trying to deal with some big themes about the extent of freedom we have in our lives, big questions of suffering, of self-doubt. And all this came out as a novel narrated by a Cornish Methodist preacher, set at the end of the 19th century. And there's some kind of family history. I was brought up in a Methodist family, so it was kind of familiar territory to me. But for some reason, it just seemed a very good territory for exploring the kind of themes I wanted to. And it ended up being written as well without any commas in, which was also intentional. And ideally, you shouldn't be able to tell that at all when I do the reading. The punctuation was never the point. It just was a way of communicating the narrator's illiteracy while still trying to write well and write beautifully and great sentences with kind of rhythm. So I had to find a way of writing sentences without commas. It turns out commas are the most useful things in writing as well. I did myself a great disservice and I overuse them terribly now. But I tried to find a voice for him, and it was just the one thing that worked on the page. It was a voice which was had a kind of pressure of speech to it, a deep intensity. It's quite a sort of internal, internalized novel in which not much happens, except emotionally, I guess. And I'm just going to read a very short section from the middle. Just as a note of background, a Methodist preacher like Charles at the turn of the 19th century would have been an itinerant preacher. He spent his Sabbaths often with a long walk on a morning to preach at a sort of distant rural chapel in the morning, staying for an evening service and then walking back home. And there was a big crisis of faith in the countryside at the end of the 19th century, so the churches were basically empty. And not today, I've done readings when there's been very, very few people in, and I always feel like it's a good bit to read because about a preacher going to preach to a very small congregation. The irony is lacking today. But the moment this piece takes place is when he's gone to preach at a clifftop chapel at a place called Crafthole on the Cornish coast. And he's walked there in the morning, preached to a very small congregation, and is facing a very long walk back through worsening weather in the evening. The chapel were near empty for the morning service. There was one old lady who sat at the furthest pew from the pulpit. She stood silent and unmoving during the hymns. The only voice I heard raised was my own. Our afternoon meeting then were not until 3, and the intervening hours slow. I waited with the steward and listened to him enumerate his cares. I found I did not greatly take to the man. Then when the hour finally came, I were again to be disappointed with the congregation. Just two others apart from us. It is a long way to come to see such little reward. I preached from my notes, felt no voice fill me, just the hard unbending word of God, which I dragged from the page and let turn on my own tongue. Well, it were an empty sermon, which could not have provided them much satisfaction, and they must return to their home still hungry. And afterwards, there were no food neither, so our bellies were empty too, just the same as our hearts. The steward apologised to me as though it were a small thing. He said that a storm were coming and we must leave quickly for home. Hinted that the congregations now were too small to warrant feeding. Well, it seemed an unnecessary meanness. I felt ill-treated. I did not think it would have required much work to have brought something for the preacher, and surely a small crowd were easier to provide for than a large one. I had brought nothing with me, and if the weather were turning, I would not have time to go with someone to the village and wait in their kitchen, while they begrudged me a small share of their own food. It was darkening when we left the church, the clouds already coloured like quarry slate after rain. The wind had got up, it felt cold on the cliff. The billowing sky blew in a great turmoil, so much so it looked like a rushing ocean went above. It appeared like it would rain, and I knew I had better soon leave. Not a day to walk on the beach as I had done as a child, the tide were high and pressing. The waves far beneath caught my eye, they crashed white on black rocks, a beautiful sight churning away, but it seemed to threaten, it were not like the morning. There were a contest between sea and these limestone cliffs, and today it looked sure the sea would win. It will still beat on the land when these rocks are worn away and we are gone before. I helped fasten the shutters over the windows of the chapel. It seemed that we were preparing for a storm like the wise men in the parable. But I did not think that this church built on rock served much purpose if no one came. We barred the wood door shut, closed the chapel tightly. No doubt it will lie empty and unused for another week. The steward then was swiftly gone, trotting off down the path. So I exchanged a few words with a couple that had come. They were a Mr. Blake and his wife. He has been a fisherman in these waters for many years. He's an old man now, the days when he took out his boat are long gone. His face were tanned skin, all shrivelled, and beneath his hat there were signs of unruly hair, strong and thick as cord, and white as salt. His wife, it transpired, is half deaf. Well, I had spoken my sermon loudly enough with a confidence I did not feel, but I do not think she heard much of it. Perhaps her heart were more attuned to our Lord's voice than her ears, and it were better that way. I only hope I did not drown the good word out. "We were happy to see a young preacher," she said. "It's always old men, and you would think we have enough of them." A slow smile on her husband's face. "I'm not so young any more," I said, leaning forward to her better ear. "Come now," she said. "All these old fellows saying the same things every week in a different chapel. It makes me quite glad I can't hear them. My ears may be going, but my mind's not yet ready to put up with nonsense. I've half a mind to get up there myself. I'd have a few things to say." "And why not?" I said. But she had turned to look at her husband and not seen me speak. It seemed that much of her ability to hear were by her sight. "How are your legs?" she asked him. "Are you ready to go now?" "His legs are bad," she said to me. Her husband there, still smiling. A slight shake of his head, which may have been an answer. Something in his eye, I thought. But he were quiet. And it is the same with many of the fishermen I have known. They are accustomed to solitude on their boats, and even if the world were ending about them, they could abide with patience until it were their time. They have waited for the earth, so why not for heaven too? Still something in his eye kept me, and though I listened to the woman and answered, I could not stop watching his face. she saw me looking. "Don't you mind Joshua," she said. "Sometimes he's still half out to sea." The slow smile spread a little, and I felt that it were not for her, but for me. He smiled at me with something shining, some memory or thought that came with clouds and water in his mind, and old sunlight behind them breaking through. I saw the ocean swimming in his eyes, and then suddenly I were afraid again. Afraid for age and passing, for being claimed by loss, enveloped in its mystery. We have no freedom. If I live as old as him, I will wither similarly. I will grow weak and look hazy-eyed and broken to my youth, and will not even have the comforts that are afforded him. A wife, a home, and the sea in his eyes. I thought then that I would die alone. He were watching me. The fear shook in my spine a little. I felt that I were tired, that these dark thoughts came upon me more easily when my body were weak. "A good sermon," he said. He shook my hand. A tough grip, more iron than muscle. My arm trembled. He held my eye. His wife fussed beside him, straightening his coat. And then the two of them thanked me for coming and bade me a fair journey, though I saw them look to the sky and knew that they thought of their own walk home. Well, I smiled at their concern, not begrudging them their rest, but we could almost see the houses of Crafthall from where we stood. They were not at all far, and downhill all the way, so even if their pace were slow, they would be warm in their home before I had barely begun. Thanks so much.